I'm Lori. I'm an alcoholic. I was born and raised in the San Fernando Valley, and oh my God. I did not want to look back there. I want to welcome the newcomers and tell you that sobriety will bring you beyond your wildest dreams. My sobriety date is February 15th, 1987, and I did the math last week and told you guys my age, and somebody signed me up for AARP. it's wrong. I got sober at 28, and I turned 50 in September. And I asked my mom for a GPS tracking system, and she gave me a compass. But you know, I am just so nervous because this is such an honor and a privilege, and I'm in love with the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I just wish I could spoon feed you guys. And I want to thank Felix for asking me to participate. He said that the committee voted it to be a topic meeting in its sex and sobriety. So we'll be out of here in 3 minutes. So, the purpose of me being up here, if you're new, is to tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now in a general way. And that's hard for me. Those of you that know me, I'm not really good at that general way part. I give you the dirt, and then my sponsor said it needs to be 15-minute increments so that I'm not drunk at 9 o'clock still. And I'll do the best I can. But I just, I was born and raised in Los Angeles, California. My dad was LAPD homicide detective, and he was a national horseshoe champion for 10 years, and he was also a nudist. So yeah, I had to work on this rigorous honesty stuff, and I'm telling you, you know, it was really stressful whether to have your girlfriends over, because you never knew where dad was. And you know, the good news is that he threw 99.9% ringers, so when you heard a cling cling out there, you knew daddy was naked. And that's the good news. That's the good news. And then my mom is still alive. She's 80 years old. She's full-blooded Italian, and she was a teacher at a Catholic high school, and a sports writer, and she's also closet gay, to make it even more fun. And she hated nudity, if you know what, get my drift. So I'm like, okay, so. So I'm the third girl, right? And mommy and daddy both wanted David, and so Lori pops out, and I'm the third girl, and so they were both pissed, and I sensed that from birth, that mommy and daddy were pissed. And you know, I've worked the steps and the amends with my mom and dad, and you know, I did through the years go through lots of rage and lots of, you know, I'll never look back, you know, I just owe them. But I have you know, come to peace with that situation, because like Norm Alpe, one of the legend speakers, says, you know, if it wasn't for the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I could have missed it all, you know. When I was 5 years old, you know, instead of a rattle, they could have given me a noose and nobody would have noticed, because it was just really stressful. And Charlie Carney says that, you know, in my family, I was the disgruntled post worker, you know, and all the pictures, there's little Lori going, get me out of here. And it was a very dysfunctional family, and based on the fact that we were raised Catholic, and for some reason, when you're Catholic, if you divorce, it equals murder. So my mom and dad are still married today. But I had my first drink at 14 years old. It was, I was in the ninth grade. My dad came in and told me that my mother had left him for a nun. I'm not making this up. And she was my teacher. And so, okay, and then woven in and out of this whole growing up thing is daily drinking in my house, needless to say. We had beer on tap. We had a pool room. They still, they collected all the beer can tops, and so the ceiling to this day is, you know, celebrated with all the beer can tops, and it's beautifully decorated. And, you know, my dad was more concerned about the $40 for the keg of beer that had to be filled in that pool room than anything else. And so he would go to the local bars and drag up all the horseshoe player drunks and bring them home and run contests at our house. And, of course, beer is on tap. And, you know, so that's, you know, forever the smell of beer is in my memory. And then he would, when he was on patrol, the cops would be in the pool room drinking beer, playing pool with the radio on the table. He built a beer thing with a pad. So, with a little pad, so if the drunks hit their head, they didn't get injured. You know, God forbid we get sued. I'm growing up in this environment, and I'm thinking, I don't want to be like either one of these people, and, you know, just wanting my escape. And then the cops would be there, the radio would be on the thing, and then they'd get a call, and then they would all fly out in their cars and stuff. So that was Lori's life. And then to add more fun to it, I have a brother from another mother. I have a brother that was raised, he's a cousin, but he was raised as a brother, and he's 16 years older than me. And you know, there's a whole story with that. So there is my... the setting. And so I started drinking at the age of 14, and it just went boom right away. I was one of those blackout drinkers, the one where the high school kids are gathering around, you know, make sure Lori isn't dying, because we don't want the parents to know that we were drinking. And I was a drinker from the gate. I would down vodka straight down, to, you know, for whatever reason. And you know, I truly qualify as an alcoholic. Let me tell you that there's no question, if you want more examples, that I'm an alcoholic. And I'm a perfect example or a specimen for science, because, you know, we got mom and dad drunk all the time. My mom's drunk when she carries me. We've got a history, a line of alcoholics. And then we got a broken family, and then me, no self-esteem, and every reason to study, like, why did Lori become the alcoholic? I'm the only recovered alcoholic in my family. I have, out of six of us, I'm the only one that's in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. The rest are in their own little gambling deals and such, and they're... And what we say in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is, our hats are off to you. You know, my mom and dad, they're still driving around with the drunk, if you will, and they never got any DUIs, and their lives didn't go kaput, you know, like Lori. So I can't tell you if it's the gene, if it's because mommy was drunk, or what. But I have no reason to question why I'm an alcoholic. All I can tell you is that my life began on February 15th, 1987. And if it wasn't for the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, with lots of input, with lots of counselors, Lori had no chance. Lori had no chance. And so that is why I'm just the AA cheerleader. And I have been since I rolled back into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous in 1987. Okay, so there's a whole story of from 14 to 19. There's a whole story about that, and then what I'll start about is at the age of 18, I started smoking some pot and then eating like a batch of brownies and just acting out on a lot of stress because for whatever reason, and in my despair, I opened up the Yellow Pages, and I found the program of Overeaters Anonymous, and there the seed was planted for Lori. And at the age of 18, I went to a meeting of Overeaters Anonymous, and I what they do is they use the same big book, they have the same steps, but you put the word food into it. And then I tromped there at the age of 18, and I sat down, and there was this like 300-pound man, you know, reading, "If you want what we have," and I'm like, ah, you know. So, you know. So, when the meeting was over, I went up to the front, and I'm like, okay, how can whiskey be a grain? Is that equivalent to a bread? And, you know. And so what I got out of the program of Overeaters Anonymous, so what I got is that you need to eat healthy. So from the age of, so what they did is they, you know, said, well, you might want to try Alcoholics Anonymous. So at the age of 18, all the way through 21, I rolled into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I sat in the back because I wasn't you guys. I liked brownies too much, and I'd have my peppermint schnapps in my pocket, and I would listen to what you had to say, and I was just a very lonely, lost girl, and the basket would come around, and I would hear, "Take what you can and leave the rest." So I would just steal the money, you know. And so if anybody knows The Nest in Reseda, California, it's probably the seediest Alana club in the United States, and that's where I went. And Jewel talked last week, and you know, I get a tear in my eye, and I think about, which I wanted to mention, is Jay, George, and the Jewels in this program of Alcoholics Anonymous, because it wasn't for the fact that when I came back to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, the Jays and the Georges and the Jewels treated me like a lady because I didn't know that I was one. And, you know, that I realized because I always cry when these guys share. And it's like, why do I get so touched? And it's because how you guys treated me this last time. And why that makes me cry is because the Nest didn't have that saying, you know, treat her like a lady until she knows that she is one. I'm the poster child for 13th step, you know, at the age of 19. And I just got, you know, this guy wanted to ride home and after the meeting and read the big book with him. There was no reading involved. And so hence I developed a strong resentment for the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I hit the bars at 21, and it was off to the races. And there's a saying, there's nothing worse than a belly full of booze and a head full of AA, and I'm that person, because from the age of 18 to 28, when I finally got sober, I was just not a lot of fun at the parties, because you know they would be passing the drugs and passing the alcohol and doing the shots, and I would be saying, "Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly," you know. So what I did, okay, so maybe that's what it's like now. No, that's that middle part. Okay, what happened? So what happened is I kept rolling in and out of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous from the age of 18 to 28. There's a country song by K.T. Oswin, "Come Monday. Come Monday, I'm going to stop loving you." And I had this saying, "Come Monday, I'm going to start my diet and I'm going to stop drinking." And that just kept happening and happening. And weeks and 21 went by and 22 went by and 23 went by. And at 23 years old, I got pulled over for drunk driving. And the cops pulled up and I had this attitude. I don't know where the nail file came from, but that's how I envisioned myself. And I said, "You know what? My dad's a cop. You better look him up on your computers." And they would just go back to the car, and they would come back, and they said, "Get some coffee, honey, and leave your car here." And that happened that one time. And then I went rolling back into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I would come in here, and I would just, you know, chill out and shake out, and that incomprehensible demoralization of what happened the night before, coupled with my love of money, I would my hangovers consisted of like waking up on a Saturday morning, counting how many Long Island iced teas and kamikazes, and of course the whiskey, because that was a grain, and then I would. So my subconscious or whatever would start counting how much I spend, and it was always $60 on booze and $100 on drugs, and then I kept going. I'd wake up every year going, "Oh man, multiply that by 26 weeks, I could have owned a boat," and you know, I'd keep rolling in and out of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and then the second time, I had Diet Coke and whiskey, because that was 100 calories, and then some Maui Wowie, because that's natural. And then I started, like, Long Island iced tea is kind of colorful, so that's kind of like the fluffy salad group. And Bloody Mary, of course, is your vitamin A, and then you got the celery, that's your salad group. And I just got really creative with this orange juice and vodka and mix and match. And I left the bar, and I think I still have the insurance papers on this. I left the bar, and I crashed into a station wagon on Canoga and Van Nuys, and those people thought I was pulling over to exchange information, but instead I just kept driving, and then I made a right on Van Nuys, and then a left on Varial Street. And if you want to Google it when you get home, Varial has an end to it because it's a cul-de-sac. So I was looking behind me for the cops to be chasing me, and didn't know that the street ended. So I crashed and totaled an El Camino, and crawled out of my Camaro, and just asked the crowd, you know, "Do you know who my dad is?" And swear to God, I mean, you could ask my mom. This is the truth. And my mom came and picked me up. And again, that was like, you know, come Monday, I'm going to quit drinking. And I'm going to start a diet, and I'm going to get over you. And so I would show up at the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I would just try really hard to listen to you guys. But you all lost your wives and your houses and your jobs. And oh my God, I still have my Camaro and my job. And I just couldn't relate. And the smoke was so bad. And then these ladies with blue hair would come up, and they just would have that, like, gruffy chain smoking voice and go, "Honey, you know, do you want what we have?" And I'd just be like, I'm too cute. And okay, so the second, that was the second event. And then the third event, I think I was 26. I started thinking, why do I have to keep drinking every Wednesday, every Friday, and every Saturday? And I would just try to quit Monday, but then Monday, you can't quit Monday. You can't quit drinking on Monday because you got Wednesday, and Wednesday is hump night. So you got to drink on Wednesday. And then since you drink on Wednesday, you might as well drink Friday because that's like the weekend. And then you wake up Saturday morning, and my roommate would be, you know, bringing me an aspirin, and I'd have a big hangover, and the demoralization And I began, you know, losing bras and my legs, nylons, you know, wherever. You know, there's a lot of country songs where you kind of wake up and you're going, you know, who am I? You know, I sure loved him, but I don't know his name. And then it got about money for me. It's like I paid $3.99 for those leg nylons, and I left them at his house. And so then I turned into a stalker. I would, like, leave these people that I'd wake up with because I was so scared. And then I'd go home, and it was like, oh, my God, that's like $10 sitting at his house. I want to get my nylons and my underwear back. And so I would, you know, show up back at these strangers' house, and it's like, can I have my underwear and my bra? And I shared at my home group. Well, you know, I'm really glad I'm not drinking now, because Victoria's Secret is very expensive. But I shared at my home group, you know, if I had all the bras and underwear that I left out there, I could open a boutique. And the men in the meetings are all, we have it here. Where did it go? So then I'm like 26 years old, and I'm also, the reason why science should study me also is because I'm dyslexic, and that goes back to when I was 5 years old. I had meningitis, and they told my parents that I would either be deaf or brain damage, and I can hear very well. So, I just was kind of, the people that know me, there's people that know me, and I'm a cuckoo bird, I admit that. And when it got to with my drinking, that I thought, well, why is everybody else having loving lives and loving husbands and all these, you know, families, and my girlfriends are all getting married on me, and I'm just more concerned about, you know, Madonna songs and going to the disco on a Friday night, and, you know, what gloves I was going to wear, and the mini dress and the 4-inch pumps. And I got pulled over on Ventura Boulevard, leaving the one bar for drunk driving, and the two highway patrolmen pulled me over, and I should have been in jail. I should be searched. And I said, sir, you know, if I wouldn't have to be out here drinking if I had a husband and children at home. So, now I asked the cops if they had anyone they could set me up with, and I had a gram of cocaine in my pocket, and I was heading to the Tennessee Gin and Cotton, and I had my little club card, and I was more concerned about getting to that club. And some reason, I probably threw in my dad's name, you know, do you know my dad? Because they let me go and drive drunk on the 101 freeway, and same old story. You know, Lori wakes up and goes, oh, my God, I should have been strip searched. I should have been strangled by the stranger I woke up next to. You know, at that time, I was in Chatsworth, and that time, and Chatsworth was the hills in those days. And I woke up next to some guy, and I asked him his name, and his name was Bear. I'm like, oh, my God, I'm in the woods, and I'm with a guy named Bear. And So I go home, and I go to sleep, and I wake up, and I got that demoralization, and then I'm thinking, I should have been strip searched. How much money did I spend last night? Let's multiply that by 26 weeks out of the year. I'm spending $5,000 a year in drinking. I could have bought a yacht. And then I would roll into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was the same old thing. The woman had blue hair, and, you know, and I just didn't hear the music at that time. And so, okay, then there's another drunk driving, which is really sad. I was at the Universal Studios doing my bump, my disco dancing, and somebody in the parking lot probably would have raped me, but for some reason my dad taught me where to kick the guy in, and I did the old and drove away and got pulled over on the freeway, and the cops were all around me, and I said, you know, I just almost got raped. Can you look at these bruises? And they put the flashlight on me, and I had bruises, and they said, okay, honey, why don't you get yourself right home? And I qualify as an alcoholic. And so February 13th, 1987, it was my bottom because I was too proud to have somebody buy me a drink. For some reason, in those days, if they bought you a drink, you owed them something. So I wasn't going to be like my mother and depend on and use a man for his money. I'm going to be, you know, pay for my own. And my bottom was that Friday morning when somebody had shared some drugs with me, and he looked at me like he expected something, and I thought, I'm at my bottom because this is my bottom to me. And there's something else about that. So that was a Friday, and I walked into the pool room where my dad was, and I was 28 years old, and I said, Dad, I'm an alcoholic. And he said, you're not an alcoholic, Lori. I said, I'm a cocaine addict, and I need your help. And he said, I don't know what to do for you. All I know is to put handcuffs on you and book you. And he walked out of the house. And I went to my room, and I got down on my knees, and I grabbed the 24-hour book from the Overeaters Anonymous program and started reading and called my brother and said, Dad won't help me, Dad won't help me. So my brother was director of Burbank Studios. He was the technical services director of Warner Brothers, and so he had some really fancy insurance plan. So they tromped me into the Warner Brothers EERP or whatever, the employee assistance program, and to set me up with into a rehab. So I toured a rehab that night, and I knew the next day was Valentine's Day, and I was not going to be in a rehab on Valentine's Day. And I still had that. I had that bottle of Korbel champagne at home, and I just thought, you know, I'm not an alcoholic because my drinking's getting a lot classier. And then the strawberry in the champagne is your vitamin A, too. And so they trot me. My brother was just disgusted. My mom and dad didn't know what to do because the cocaine word. And that same time, I had a boyfriend of 5 years. That same event, he had told me he wanted to be a cocaine dealer. And that same week, I said, what am I going to tell my dad that you do? So we broke up. So when this rehab event was all about Ed and feeding me cocaine, and they let me tour this North Hollywood rehab, and I walked in there, and the guys had tattoos, and that meant really bad things then. And the woman had bandanas, and I thought, my case is different. And this lady, she had 15 years, and she was a chain smoker with the teeth, tobacco teeth, and she looked at me and she said, honey, will you promise me one thing? If you drink again, will you come back here? And I said, sure I will. And the next day was Valentine's Day, and then I had another demoralization event that scared the bejeebers out of me. And then that Sunday morning, I went into my mom and I said, I need help. And she said, I want my Lori back. And she laid in the bed with me because I was so hungover and so distraught from what had happened the night before. And they said, well, you know, let's give you to rehab. I said, I'm not going to that North Hollywood place. I want to go to Betty Ford. And so my family got together that Sunday, and they told me that Burbank rehab was where all the movie stars went, and that I'd be going to celebrity rehab. And that so they talked me into the Burbank hospital. And they checked me in, and I was filing my nails. I always seem to have a nail file with me, filing my nails while they're interviewing me into this hospital. And they said, you know, what's your belief in God? And I just said, you know, if my mom and dad were happily married, then I would believe that there's a God. And, you know, he just shook his head, and I was thinking, what does that have to do with anything? And So I did the rehab, and they told me to. They said to find a God of your understanding, and somebody. I heard somebody say that, you know, that first they didn't know about this God thing, and they named their God Harold, because our Father who art in heaven, Harold be thy name. And so I had to reverse my Catholic God, and I turned him into this other God. And at that time there was a speaker, circuit speaker, who I was seeing in her house named Dottie Shore. She would counsel you for like $40, and you know, she would say, "Why do you go out there and drink?" And her tape says that God is good orderly direction, good old dad, and a group of drunks. And so that's what I bought. And so there's Lori. Lori's so I'm 28 years old, and I didn't know what this God thing was. So I left the rehab, and I graduated, and. In rehab, my family showed up all drunk, and they all got kicked out. And so, I do not see what's funny about any of this. It's really sad. It's sad. I could tell like another part of my story, and people will have like tears dropping down their face onto the ground, and I'm like so matter-of-factly about this life I have, but anyone that knows me knows that sobriety is the most important thing in my life without exception. And if it wasn't for that, rooms like these and people like you, where would Lori be today, you know? And in the rehab, I was going to split because it was like 23 guys and 3 girls, and you guys all lost your wives, your husbands, and your jobs, and I'm like, I still have my Camaro, and, you know, and I shared this last week. The counselor said, write 5 things that are important to you, and it was very powerful. And so we went around the room, and the men were bawling, you know, my wife, my children, my job, my health, and it came to me, and I said, my Camaro, my family, my health, my job, and my FICA score, not really. And the counselor just looked at everybody and he said, you all missed the point. Sobriety should be the first thing on your list. And I'm like, I'm not an alcoholic, and I didn't lose things like these people here. And so I went to the room and I started ironing my disco outfit, and the men from there took a turn and came into the ironing room with me, and I'm just like, effing this. And I'm like, I am so out of here. And somehow I envisioned their wings took a hold of me and grabbed me back in, and they said, let's go have ice cream social. And it's like, oh my God, I'm dying. Ice cream. And so that was a turning point. So then the counselor said, and I said, my case is different. I didn't lose anything like you guys. I didn't have anything to lose, and my case is different. And the counselor said, when you're on a runaway train, honey, you could jump off at any time. Establish this as your bottom and move forward. And that got my attention, and I graduated that little rehab. And what they did, what we do now, and I don't know if people know the purpose of why a token gets passed around the room, is when I graduated my 28 days, my family came and they behaved themselves, and the class was there, and you take your token, and what you do is you rub your love into the coin, and you say something really, you know, supporting and generous, and then you pass the coin, and when the coin gets passed, I always think about that what we're doing is we're rubbing the love into the coin. And I don't know, how much more time do I have? 10 minutes? Okay. I wanted to just read something. Oh, gosh, and there's so much to talk about. They said to get a sponsor, and it's like, I hate women, and I went to a meeting, and this woman like me, the woman like me was up there speaking in a room like this. And I'm 28 years old, and sobriety is the most important thing in my life without exception. And I realize it's the, you know, body, whatever that addiction story is, what thing is. But, I went up, and she's the sponsor lady, this lady like me, Sharon, and she says she woke up from a blackout, and she was hanging from these S&M hanging things, getting whipped. And I'm like, that is so cool. And she had 5 years sobriety, and she was like God to me. And I went up and asked her to be my sponsor. And she was from the Pacific group. And so she said, okay, you need to follow my direction. You need to call me every morning at 7:30. You need to come out. You need to come to these meetings. Oh, see, I get so grateful. And I'll do whatever you say. And they talked about this guy named Clancy, and I'm like, oh, there's got to be some guys there. And, okay. So I'm calling her every morning at 7:30. Every morning at 7:30, and she's making me go from the San Fernando Valley across the 405 to Brentwood 3 times a week to those meetings. And I'm calling her every morning at 7:30, and I'm holding the phone and flipping her off. And, you know, it's called getting to know each other. And, you know, whatever, you know. And she said, you know, you must have a problem with intimacy. And I'm like, how do you know that? And she says, you like to go dancing a lot. And one thing I made in my commitment in the rehab when I graduated, he said to write four things that you want out of sobriety and seal the envelope. And so what I wrote down is to visit all the states in the United States, because I never left the bar. And I wrote, God's not going to take my dancing away, because I love to dance. So I made a hobby out of country western dancing. And then I travel throughout the United States, and I pay my ticket, and each ticket is usually $300, and to me that's a bottle of Korbel champagne and a gram of Coke. So that's how I rationalize spending this money. And in the last 22 years, I've been to 35 states, and I've been to honky-tonks in all those states, because I'm a country western dancer. So I would call my sponsor, and I would say, you know, I went dancing, because we started like a sober dancing group, and she had me work the steps, and I would go out to these Clancy meetings, and there weren't any guys that were my type, because they all had to shave their mustaches, and I like the seediest, you know, I like mustaches, tattoos, and preferably a Harley. And Clancy's rule is you can't have a mustache, and the men have to stick with the men, which really sucks. And the women have to stick with the woman, and the women have to wear a dress. And I was going to wear jeans tonight. They're in my car. And there were several women that helped me dress in the bathroom to put this dress on, because I didn't want to piss Clancy off. And what I got out of the Pacific group is, you know, I would drive every Wednesday. And if none of you know what the Pacific group is like, there's probably an average of 1,200 people there on a Wednesday night. It's at a Jewish synagogue in Brentwood. You'll see maybe one or two movie stars. I've seen three tops. And they have to arrange it with service work. They have like 10 parking attendants, 10 cigarette, you know, picker-uppers, and 5 handshake and door greeters. And when I, you know, I had to meet Karen there, and I'd walk through there, and they would be like, hi, Susie, hi, Bill. And I wouldn't shake their hands. I'm like, I came here to get spiritual. I didn't come here to shake anybody's hands. And so to fast forward that, I worked the steps with Karen in her Santa Monica apartment. I did the first, second, third step. There's a part of the third step that says we preferably take it with somebody else on our knees, preferably. I'm on my knees in her Santa Monica apartment. and, you know, peeking out to see if, you know, God's going to show up. And I did nothing, and nothing happened. And I went home that next, and the next day I shared in the meeting. I said, you know, I did the third step, and no burning bush jumped out. And somebody said that it's the actions that you take in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous that furthers you to your commitment to your sobriety. And the reason why you don't feel something for when you're doing these steps as far as a burning bush is because you're just committing yourself to the program by one foot in front of the other. And there was another epiphany for me because I thought, wow, I'm doing the deal. Lori never did the deal before. And, you know, there's a lot to say about Clancy's group. You know, I love Clancy. I had to defend him when I moved down here because he's just an awesome, awesome guy. And that structure is exactly what Lori needed. You know, they said if you want to build your sobriety, it's like building a house, and you need to have the footings, and you need to lay the concrete, and you need the rebar. And for me, the Pacific Group was the concrete, the rebar, and the footings for me, because I just, you know, all I had to listen to growing up was my dad's music, like Make the World Go Away and Take It Off My Shoulders, and you know, Born to Lose, and Now I'm Losing You. But he would change it because he was always with all the other neighborhood women, and he'd say Born to Lose, Born Too Loose is what he would sing. And fast forward, there's nothing more important to me, you know, than I don't want to get corrected at the end of this, but there's nothing more important to me than a candle on my cake. But that doesn't mean that, you know, that's the answer. For me, that's the answer, and what that entails is a loving God, a sponsor, a home group, a sobriety date, working the steps, working with others, being of service, doing commitments. For me, I travel about three states a year, and then I hit the Alano clubs, the honky tonks, and the Harley stores. And I'll just keep going. I brought some props because I want to tell you. And then my mom comes down here on a train to give me my cake because she could not be any more proud to have her Lori back. And I went to Memphis, Tennessee, and I was in Elvis's backyard, and there was a payphone in the line there while you're entering the tour to see his costumes. And my mom, when she gave me my 15-year cake, she read my amends letter to the group, and it was really beautiful. You know, thank you, Mom, for being there, for all those phone calls, you know, early in the night. And so she's really proud of my program. And I'm in Elvis's backyard, and there's a payphone, and we're in line trying to go look at his costumes. I pick up the payphone, and I go, Mom, guess where I'm at? And she says, where? I said, I'm in Elvis's backyard. And she said, I'm all shook up. There's a lot more stories about that. And then the fast forward, I think 15 years sobriety, my home group was drunks only. You guys might have heard the story. My fiancé at the time gave him my 15-year cake, and then he got down on his knees and proposed to me, and it blew the whole room away, and we got married, and then we got divorced. And we got divorced a year later. He left me for a bartender. He said she was more fun, and then the sobriety stuff, and he said, AA just is a bunch of people that like hearing themselves talk, and I'm just like, so? You know? And I just, the two most profound things that happened in my life all happened within 3 months' time. My wiener dog of 16 years, Kuja, she never saw me drunk. She died on December 11th, and I had, whatever, 3 years ago, whatever, 2 years ago, I had the most pain I've ever had in sobriety, and I wanted to drink. And what I learned from you guys is that you suit up and show up and you be of service. And I showed up at the Sunday night meeting, and the La Jolla speakers, what's it called? Sunday night. Old Town. I went to Old Town Speakers. Kuja had just died, and I went up to the treasurer. They had the door, the table up there, and I said, I want to be of service, but, you know, I have a lot of years, and I don't want to, like, have a really bad job. And and Tom Navarro came up from the back, and he said, you know what? We need a cigarette butt picker-upper. So I was the cigarette butt picker-upper for that meeting, and it saved my life from the death of Kuja. And what I tried to do is I would pick up the cigarette butts, and then I would try to talk everyone into quitting smoking. So they fired me from that job. Not really. So what I want to say is, like, service has saved my butt. And then during that time, my ex-husband had come to me, and he made what I call his amends, and he was in deep regret because of his drinking. He, you know, left with a bartender, and we tried to reconcile for whatever which way. Thank you. We reconciled. I called my sponsor, and she just, as usual, just said, far out. Make sure that you're being of service. And we gave it a go, and we hung out, and he got me. He finally got me, because he didn't understand why I like to go to honky-tonks, and he finally got me, and he finally got me and my sobriety, and the reason that the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is so important to me. And then I had a moment of clarity, because he was riding around in his Harley drunk, and I thought, what is a lady like me doing with a drinking Harley guy? And I split up with him on December 11th, the day that Kuja died. And 3 months later, they found his foot buried in 3,000 pounds of snow up in Julian. And his drunk girlfriend left him for dead for a day. And that was the second most pain for me. But what I did is I just let, this is his motorcycle patch. I came to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I said, I'm going to be a woman of dignity. And you guys put your arms around me. And he said, go back out there and be a woman of dignity. And I showed up at that funeral, and there was about 200 people, and the police were there to hold the bartending chick away from me. And I walked through there, and I said a prayer, and I thought about you guys. And when I walked into the room, like a woman of dignity, all I thought about is, if I act wrong here, what are they going to think about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous? What kind of example am I going to be? When I walked into the room, it's all as if the waves parted, and they let me walk all the way through to his casket, and I made my amends. And I didn't want to talk about this, but the point of that is that if you need to make your amends when people are alive, because there's nothing worse than amends that way. I didn't want to talk about that. I guess the point is, now that I'm on the internet again, he was really cool. He would always sign me up for wet t-shirt contests. And I'd be like, what are my program friends going to say? But I'll shut this up, because now I'm feeling pathetic. But, you know, the point is, when you're a weeping gal like me, this is what I've been doing. This is how I stay sober. I tell myself and I tell the truth. It's not always just fine. When I called my sponsor, being dyslexic, and I asked her, what about sex? She said, read page 69. It says, we ask God what we should do in each specific matter. Being the dyslexic that I am, I accidentally opened to page 96, working with others. Do not be discouraged if your prospect does not respond at once.
Search out another alcoholic and try again. There's two more. You are sure to find someone desperate enough to accept with eagerness what you have to offer. We find it a waste of time to keep chasing a man who cannot or will not work with you. A kindly act once in a while isn't enough. You have to act the Good Samaritan every day if need be. So that's my little joke. I'm almost done, right? And I just want to end it with my most favorite place in my big book, which is this one. Page 477, and I think they left it out in the new one. It's the Join the Tribe. It's an Indian who's writing. I have traveled much. At every place I find AA group first. Go to many meetings. Carry message to those who listen. Put cork in bottle. No drunk hopeless if you want to follow guide along right trail. Go to AA meetings. Listen, not just hear noise. Get sponsor and phone numbers. Call friend in AA when bad thoughts come. Let group spirits of love and understanding protect you. Take my hand. Walk with me up the 12 steps of AA to peace. To Indians, I say, don't be afraid to join AA. I once here...